Midnight Mass listeners. Midnight Mass listeners, come out to play. Come out to play. Ching, ching, ching. Hello, everybody. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ. And, well, it's the season two finale episode of the Midnight Mass podcast. And boy, oh boy, are we going out with a bang. But before we introduce this week's movie, of course, I have to bring on my fantastic co-host, the one, the only, it's Michael Verratti.
Well, hey there, boppers. It may be the end of season two, but Peaches and I still need to get to the shore by morning. So we're just glad that we get to talk to you a little bit about this movie on our long journey there. Do you like that, Peaches?
Sure do. What movie are we doing?
Well, of course, we're talking about 1979's The Warriors, directed by Walter Hill and starring Michael Beck, James Remar, Deborah Van Valkenburg, and a whole host of miscreants, punks, and ruffians. I'm so excited to talk about this movie because I think that in the trajectory of Midnight Mass and cult films, this movie is obviously a cult film, but I think that there will be listeners that are going to be surprised that we're talking about it.
It's so funny, this whole thing about cult films, and especially in relationship to our podcast, because of course, if you're a listener of the Midnight Mass podcast, we're serving up cult cinema for sure, no doubt, but very much through the lens of Michael and Peaches. And The Warriors is undoubtedly a cult film. There's no question about that. Everyone agrees. Anyone that knows shit about cult films knows that The Warriors is an important cult movie, but it's also very masculine. It's about a lot of boys. It's about gangs. I have to say, I really, really love it, you know, and I'm really glad that we are doing it because I got to take another dive into The Warriors, and I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. It's not that I didn't like it. I think that I liked it. I mean, I liked movies like it. You know, I remember watching, you know, Eddie and the Cruisers and, you know, all sorts of sort of, you know, like dude movies, you know, what was the Outsiders, you know, like there's sort of this sort of genre of young men and movies that I quite enjoyed. But The Warriors, for whatever reason, isn't one that I visited repeatedly. And now I just am so glad that we're doing it because I just loved it so much. And I think you agreed. It is a fabulous movie.
Obviously, Peaches and I clearly loved it enough that in our intro to this episode, we both kind of cosplayed different characters. You were, of course, evoking Luther, who clinks the bottles together and does the famous come out and play. And then when I slid in, I tried to do my best seductive radio MC who journeys us through the movie. And it's because I think that you and I got to really fall in love with this movie all over again for the first time in a lot of ways in the exploration of this episode.
That's one of the best ways to put it. I bet there are listeners who are more like us with regard to The Warriors, where they're going, you know, I need to rewatch that, or I need to watch it for the first time or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we have listeners out there who go, The Warriors is my religion. I know every line. I love that movie. I've been watching it on repeat. As we know, one of our guests is one of those people. And the other guest is maybe a little more like us, you know, in some ways. So I love that part of cult movies where we can all, it's never too late. I guess that's a way to put it. It's never too late. And all of us can sort of share our obsessions and hopefully feed new obsessions to our friends or whatever.
I love the idea that it's never too late because I think that that is the truth of cult. Cult is always there, always waiting. You just have to discover it on your own terms. And that's what makes cult films special. We find them when we need them. And in the case of The Warriors, it's interesting because it's always been there. And to me, it's always been sort of this omnipresent film that existed in the ether, but it's not something that I always thought to turn my attention to. When I was in college, I had a UHF or cable access or however you want to describe it show on our local college station. And the College Station TV2 used to have a station card that utilized a clip from the Warriors of Luther clinking the bottles saying, "Warriors, come out to play, yay." And then it would say, "Kent State's TV2, you know, you're watching TV2. So we would be in the studio recording our dumb little sketches. Then we would see that every week ad nauseum. So it was always in the back of my mind, oh, that's that movie.
They really made a mistake though. I mean, if you're going to go to the trouble of cutting and stealing something from the Warriors, it should have been, "I'll shove that bat up your ass and turn you into a popsicle." That's the line you want.
I would say the reasons were because of Kent State University's standards and practices department, but I can say that we didn't have one based on the shit we used to get away with.
So. I think that line, "I'll shove that bat up your ass and turn you into a popsicle," that's the quote we need on a t-shirt. So someone out there, just make me that t-shirt. Could you?
You know what? I hope someone does. I liked that at the beginning, we also sort of acknowledged that this maybe isn't the kind of movie that you think of when you think of Peaches and Michael. But even in our deconstruction of the movie with the guests, we did talk about how there are some queer elements to this movie and how Walter Hill knowingly included some queerness in this movie. And I think that that is really crucial because I don't hear it discussed a lot when people kind of unpack the Warriors and discuss the Warriors. But this movie in many ways is about chosen family. Like these folks who live in this lawless world have to find like minds and basically camaraderie amongst a world of misfits. Even though it maybe on the surface doesn't read as queer in the way that some of our deconstruction of some of the other cult films we talk about, the chosen family theme is so strong there that I can't help but take it into consideration when thinking about this.
It's basically like the underground ballroom scene of New York if it were straight guys. You know what I mean? Like it's sort of like these guys, you know, are misfits, or you use the word miscreants, you know,
yeah.
And you get the sense that they probably don't have great families, or, you know, they're out running the streets all night long. They only have each other, you know? And so there is a sort of queerness to that.
And I love that you said it's kind of like the balls or like the drag houses for straight guys. We even see the gamut of that, the orphans and they're just gray sweatpants, or sort of like the queens who come with their shake and go wigs, like first time at the ball. And yeah. Then you get people like the Furies who are like, "Oh no, no, darling, we've been doing this for a while."
Yeah, 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 totally. As we mentioned, this is our season 2 finale. We're taking a little summer break, just a little one, to prepare for season 3 and to start getting new content all lined up. If you are one of our Patreon subscribers, or if you'd like to become one, we will continue to populate our Patreon with new content, and we'll be making mini mass episodes. That's where Michael and I do a shorter version of the Midnight Mass podcast, a lot more raw, lo-fi, if you will. And we'll be continuing to engage over there while we prep for season 3. But we want to thank you so much, all you listeners, whether you're a Patreon subscriber or not, for just tuning in and listening and giving us an audience so that we can continue to talk about these cult movies. And I can't believe, Michael, we're wrapping season 2 as we speak.
We still have a little bit of a journey before we wrap up the entirety of the episode. So why don't we move on to the person who brought us this movie in the first place? Our next guest is someone who I know out in the world here in Los Angeles, and I had started talking to her about joining us for an episode of Midnight Mass because she's a huge horror nerd. While we were trying to find a horror movie to talk about, she mentioned in passing that she loved The Warriors, and that was the light bulb that ignited this whole episode. And what I love is her journey discovering this movie couldn't be more her, but also more delightful. Please join us in welcoming amazing comedian and entertainer Samantha Hale, who's going to discuss The Warriors with us right now. Welcome back, listeners. Well, it's a long walk from the Bronx back to Coney Island, but luckily, Peaches and I are joined in our journey by our next guest. A celebrated stand-up comedian with more than a decade in the game, you can catch her debut special, Only Happy When It's Raining Men, on Amazon Prime Video now. What's more, a kindred spirit, she has created and hosts a monthly show at the legendary Hollywood Improv called Horror Nerd that allows iconic funny people to celebrate their love of fright. She's an actress, a podcast host, and a friend to drag performers near and far. Please welcome the sensational Samantha Hale. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. I am just going to listen to that part on a loop. I have never felt so accomplished. Thank you.
I have to tell you, I need to come and see a horror-themed comedy show. I mean, that, I think you're living my dream.
I would, do you know what an honor it would be to come have you? I mean, do you, you live in San Francisco, right?
I do, yeah.
It's just a zip ride down the road, come on.
I'm down there all the time. In fact, last week on Wednesday, I flew to Los Angeles.
Yes.
On Friday, I flew to San Francisco. And then on Sunday, I flew to Los Angeles. And then on Monday, I flew to San Francisco. So why not? I seem to be commuting. Yeah.
You must have a stamp card at this point.
Yes.
Well, I can say I have attended one of Samantha's Horror Nerd shows. I believe that one was a slasher themed show.
I think it was. So we do it at the Hollywood Improv and it's on Melrose. So it was the Melrose Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And it was so much fun. I recommend any fan of horror or comedy to go. And before we get started, what led you to combine those two things?
In the pandemic, in lockdown, we were all, well, fucking bored, right? We had nothing to do. So I realized, wait a minute, I live in Los Angeles. All of these iconic horror film locations are just 20 minutes up the road. So I started going to the Nightmare on Elm Street house, the Michael Myers house, the Laurie Strode house. I mean, there's so, the Child's Play 2 house. There's so many of them. And I would just make funny videos in front of it and kind of roast the killer or just say something obnoxious. And I started posting them. And I got such great feedback from people that I thought, oh, maybe this is a thing I should do. And then I developed it into like a series that I've been trying to pitch. And, you know, that takes time. I mean, it could take 10 days or 10 years, who knows.
Right,
but
right.
In the meantime, another very funny comedian, Sarah Taylor, she mentioned to me, she's like, you know, the Improv is taking on new shows right now. What if you pitched it as a live show? I thought that's a great idea. So I told them, hey, do you guys want to get weird? And they said, absolutely. And that's how it started.
So cool.
Yeah. Yes. Initially, it was like, okay, well, let's do October. It's Halloween, of course, right? And then I thought, wait a minute, what if we did all the holidays? So like for Christmas, we did the Black Christmas edition. For Valentine's Day, My Bloody Valentine. And then the Improv said, well, you know, we really love it. It's been selling out. Do you want to do this as a regular show? So now we're every third Friday of the month.
I love that. And you have a rotating cast of characters.
Yeah.
Definitely, if you have the opportunity or in the Los Angeles area, you should check it out. Now, from discussion of scary things to one long scary night, let's dig into the Warriors. I know that you have a pretty unique circumstance of how you discovered this movie. So why don't we start there?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I had no idea what this movie was at all, never even heard of it, because I watched all the older horror films, of course. And Warriors is not technically in the horror genre. But yeah, pretty terrifying when you have hundreds of people trying to kill you. But a friend of mine was in town and she said, hey, let's go to the Hollywood Forever Cemetery where they do the screenings there. It's pretty cool. You're sitting in a graveyard and there's a huge wall in the back. If you've never been, there's a huge building with a white wall and they project the screen on. That's their screen, basically.
Right.
Make a picnic and whatnot. It happened to be her birthday in June. She's like, well, I'm in town this one weekend. I have no idea what this movie was. Let's just go see it. Okay. Let's just see what it is. Great. So we get down there. We have our picnic baskets and whatnot. And all of a sudden the movie starts playing. The Warriors. It's like, oh, is this like a Conan the Barbarian kind of a thing? Or is it like a war film? No clue. And the thing was I was in a terrible mood, to be honest, when I got there, because I had to leave this concert that I was at. And the guitar player, I was so in love with him at the time. And I just wanted to be there with this guy because, you know, guitar player, non-committal, of course. So I had to convince him to love me. So the fact that I had to leave to go see a movie I'd never even heard of, I was just like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. And then the movie starts playing and immediately the music, it just drew me in. I just felt like I was transported to the 70s. The music to me almost reminds me of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. a little bit, that weird synthesizer. It's just, it's an entire atmosphere. See, especially when, you know, when you get to the, when they're in the park where Cyrus gives his big speech, I was just like, I don't know what's happening, but I'm 100% in this movie. You know, I think the guy, Jason, I think he even texted me and I was like, not now. I put the phone down. Which never happens ever. It felt like I was transported into a different world. And I was just so there for it. And it's a bunch of hot guys running around. I mean, come on. I didn't know I had a type, but I didn't know Dexter's dad was so hot. I mean, kind of a dick, but super hot.
Yes. I think transportive is a great way to describe it, because rewatching it, I always liked it, but I haven't seen it in a number of years. Like somehow it wasn't one of the cult movies that I revisited a number of times, but seeing it now, being a bit older and understanding like kind of what a fairy tale it is, but also set in a very real, you know, version of New York City at a very specific time. It's so good. It's such a great movie. And the fact that you bring up Cyrus, I think, is a great place to sort of note that that is an actor who really makes the most of their very short amount of time on screen. Like, what a memorable performance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the way, can you dig it? I'm like, yes. Oh, God, that's just like in my soul. Yes, I dig it. I dig whatever you're selling. Yes. Yes,
iconic.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's just so memorable. He's one of the most memorable characters, and he's only there for just the one scene.
I do have some nerdy trivia about him. So he was actually brought in at the 11th hour. I watched some behind the scenes stuff, you know, preparing for today. And there was a documentary. There's a few documentaries out there, but one of them, you had an interview with Walter Hill, the director. Either Walter Hill or the producer talked about the fact that they actually cast an actual gang leader to play that part. They had auditioned this gang member, and they'd gone through a lot of hoops to make sure there was going to be this authentic person from the gang world of New York at that time. And then the guy never showed up. They never heard from him. To this day, they don't know what happened to him. Wow. You know, they were working with him. They were rehearsing with him. And so they got, what's the actor's name? Roger Hill. Roger Hill was cast at the last minute. And the other actors who are in this documentary talk about when he was up there with those 1,000 extras, real New Yorker kids, you know, in their costumes, you know, being wrangled, that he commanded their attention because his performance was so good that it gave everyone chills, you know, that everyone kind of like, the AD said, oh yeah, he did everything we needed him to do because he commanded their attention.
Wow.
You feel that when you watch it.
You do. It comes through the TV.
Yeah.
That's when you're like, well, I wasn't sure if I'm really going to be into this movie, but now I know I am. 100%.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting too that Peaches mentions that Walter Hill and the producers were interested in initially casting an actual gang member for authenticity. Because Samantha, you had mentioned at the beginning, one of the first things that hooked you into this movie was the synth, the music, that awesome opening where we're kind of going through the subway and the credits are coming at you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, is authenticity something we even are looking for when we're watching The Warriors? Because part of what makes this movie interesting is it exists sort of out of joint. When I was rewatching it in preparation, I watched it with my boyfriend, Brendan, and Brendan was like, is this a dystopian future? I was like, I don't know if we're supposed to know. And I'm wondering if your take on what makes the movie work is that it kind of exists outside.
It might be. I mean, I guess I just assumed that, you know, with some of the, like, can you dig it? Like, dig it. That's a very 70s reference and just kind of some of the way that they're dressed. But I never really thought about that until you just said it. But it absolutely is timeless. I wonder if they were to remake it, if they were to make it blatantly 70s, or if they could make it more of a, like, what's that movie with Meryl Streep, The Giver? You know that?
Oh,
movie?
Yeah.
You know it's the future, but you're not really sure what's going on.
Right. For me, I was thinking about how so much of it reminded me of a comic book. And so I went to see if it was based on a comic book. And it's not, but it was based on a novel, a short novel. And the producer was attracted to the novel, got the rights to turn the novel into a movie. And then they did discuss comics a lot, apparently. And I went and researched the costume designer, who was a woman, who was great because she was basically saying, I knew nothing about gangs. You know, I grew up pretty privileged. And, you know, this was not my experience. And so I was just kind of making it up. And Walter Hill, actually, every time I would come to him with these sort of pretty insane ideas, like ideas that, like, you know, gangs in real life would not dress, you know, in full makeup and baseball costumes, right? Like, you know, like that she would have these outrageous ideas. And Walter Hill would say, I love what you're doing. Yeah. And you're part of this vision. And he credits her with a lot of the stuff that we love about it. You know, it's set in this sort of hard New York, where the graffiti, the subway, the streets feel dirty and gritty. Coney Island looks like what we would imagine Coney Island to look like. But then the characters and the costumes and stuff are in this other kind of universe of a heightened reality or fantasy.
Right. You mean it's not realistic to have a gang of mimes on a subway? What?
I wish. I wish I'd be in that gang.
I was like, but how's he going to get the Warriors if he can't get out of this box?
What's disappointing is we never get to see the mimes again. They're sort of like introduced.
No.
I know. And you're like, I want more mimes. But I will say the baseball Furies are cool as fuck. Like, they look cool.
Yeah, they're the coolest.
That was going to be my next question. Let's dig into the gangs, because there is a drag to what we're seeing in this. Like,
every
gang has a specific look, like whether it's the baseball Furies or even that just guy in his like nylon jacket, like in his roller skates, the idea of like a roller skating gang member. Right. So you've mentioned the Furies. Are there other gangs that really are just stand out to you? Do you have favorites in the movie?
I do enjoy a good roller skate. I do like the roller skates. That's pretty cool. But I think I kind of like the baseball situation, just because my favorite line from the film, and I wrote it down because I didn't want to mess it up: I'll shove that bat up your ass and turn you into a popsicle.
It's so good.
Best line ever. I mean, come on. The only other almost as good line is when he's talking to, what is the female love interest of Swans? I forget her name. Really beautiful brunette.
Mercy.
Yeah. When they first meet, and he's kind of like, oh, you know, he's kind of standoffish, a little rude to her. And he says something like, oh, you should just tie a mattress to your back. I was like, wow, dig.
The dialogue is on point. The popsicle line is the one I want on a t-shirt, you know, with the Furies, you know, featured. And I love the look of the Furies, the makeup, all of that. But if I had to answer, and like everyone on this call, I'm guessing that we wanted to see a lot more of all the gangs, you know, that are featured at the beginning, because they give us these little hints. Criticism wise, I would say I wish that the roller skating gang, I wish they were all on roller skates. You know, I think that would have been a little more exciting. But I love the Lizzies.
Me too.
I was literally just looking for their name. I'm like, oh, the girls, what are their names? Yes,
the Lizzies. Because, you know, they are stealth, right? Like, they used misogyny to their advantage. They seduced those guys. And then when it's time for them to like go for it, they're like pulling out guns and breaking chairs over people. And, you know, so they might be my favorite.
The only thing is maybe they need to work on their aim. They're in a very small apartment and they don't shoot any of them. But it doesn't matter. They're stunning. The dance scene between the two women where they're just locking eyes. It's like... Oh my God, I'm not a lesbian, but I should be. Like, this is erotic. This is just the intensity there. And they knew it, because like they knew that young kid was watching.
Yeah.
You know, they played it so smart. These girls knew what they were doing.
Although I will argue, if there is ever evidence of over crimping your hair, that one woman has it. It's like so crimped.
Maybe she got a little excited.
I love it though. It's such a, the movie aesthetically is such a snapshot. Like, one other thing I learned in the documentary was that Mercy, you know, was in that pink, like sort of that little halter top, and they were shooting, you know, night shoots in New York, and it would get very, very cold. Yeah. And so at one point, one of the other actors basically just gave Mercy a jacket to wear, you know, because she was cold, you know, between takes. And then finally she just started wearing it on camera, and Walter Hill just said, okay, well, we need to explain this. So that's why that line is in there where he says, where'd you get that jacket? And she goes, I stole it. You know, that's why she was cold on the set. So they basically gave her a jacket. But like, there's that authenticity of their costumes are sort of ridiculous, but yet they feel right for that era, right? Like they're designed in a very specific way. I almost feel like a new movie wouldn't work because so much of what I loved about watching it was that 1979 snapshot of this group of people and that style of filmmaking.
Yeah. That is part of the charm, is that it's so, I mean, it's really, it just feels like that gritty New York 70s. I don't know if it would, that magic would translate to a remake. How would they do that?
Let's talk about the character of Mercy. This movie has its own sort of brand of machismo, for sure.
Yeah.
And we talk about how the Lizzies use misogyny to their advantage, but Mercy's kind of a dubious character. How do you feel she kind of stacks up in terms of the cast of the film? Because I don't know that she's well represented, but she's not poorly represented, if you know what I mean. What's mm-hmm. your take on her?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. At first, she comes off as this, you know, this real mouthy broad. And yeah, I'm not afraid of you. And you're going to let that guy talk to you that way? And just very like, oh, whoa, okay, this girl has really got a point to prove. What's going on with here? But then I really like that you see, as the movie goes on, she just, you're like, oh, you're not such a badass. She wants to be loved. She wants to be challenged. She wants to be excited. She wants to feel alive. And maybe it's her little brother, right? That's in the orphans.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that just, clearly that gang is maybe not the cool gang on the block. You know?
I mean, they are just wearing gray sweats, but.
Yeah. And
they weren't even invited to the party. You
that's
know,
what I was going to say. Yeah. So maybe I think she is really looking for adventure and for something. And you know, when you, sometimes you meet someone and you're just drawn to them immediately. I think she saw Swan and she was like, what is this guy? I don't know. And they're kind of both unavailable and hurt, but want to be loved so bad. So they come off as really tough as nails. And yeah, you know, I think they balance each other well. Yeah.
I agree. I think that one of the things I like about the film is that it's not overwritten. And so we're coming to these conclusions based on the performances that the actors give that really don't spell it out for you. And I agree with you, although I did think that her connection to the orphans was that guy was her boyfriend, but I guess it was probably her brother. I don't know. Again, I don't know that they ever tell us. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, true.
So I think we just all we connect the dots. But I definitely connected the dots the way you did, where she's this New York tough badass because she has to be. Yeah. You know, she's a survivor who probably comes from a tough experience. She's tough, you know, she's been toughened up, but really she just wants to be loved. And so she kind of falls in with the Warriors and specifically Swan. And like, I think when she realizes he's not a total asshole, there's like room there for connection. And there's that moment where he almost seems like he's going to like sexually assault her. And
then
he rips her, he rips her skirt, you know, to make the Molotov cocktail. And I think that's one of those moments where the filmmaker's saying, this is the kind of guy Swan is. He's not interested in, you know, dominating a woman that way. And then of course we get the other scene with Ajax, where he is sexually assaulting a woman and then he gets handcuffed to a park bench.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with your take on it, Samantha. So Michael, what was it about her that bothers you? Because I think obviously it's not like she's some feminist representation of a strong, you know, woman in a movie. She's still a secondary character, but was there something specifically that upset you about her?
No, I think that the way both of you have unpacked her character has really helped in terms of my perception. But there is that thing where I felt like until later in the movie, for a good chunk of her early participation, she mostly is just a foil for them and their masculine aggression. And it bothered me, but it also is something that I can contextualize as being of the time. And I do think that by the end of the movie, we do get a turnaround. And one thing that I will say about this movie, as opposed to other movies of the era, is it never glorifies that behavior. And in many ways, also holds them accountable. Like when you mention Ajax trying to sexually assault the woman, but then she turns it around and handcuffs him. By the way, that woman is future Academy Award winner Mercedes Rule in one of her first roles, right?
It is?
Yep.
No.
That's so great.
I had no idea. And I even did the research. I'm embarrassed.
And that's the thing, like, because Ajax is the one that kind of uses all the he uses the F slur multiple times. He's the only character who does. He's like the most poorly behaved of the warriors, but he kind of gets his. And it's sort of like, just because he's part of the name group of the movie doesn't mean he won't be held accountable. And I do kind of appreciate that.
Well, of course, he's the one I'm the most attracted to because I'm so fucked up. He is the only one that uses the F word, and he is a monster, and he's the one I was the most interested in, you know. And you know, that actor has shown up in a million things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, his last name is, James.
James Remar, right?
James Remar. I think we could all agree it's James Rimmer.
I think that's maybe what you would like it to be.
Oh, yes. Yes. Overall, for being a movie that comes out in 1979, and Samantha, we talk a lot about this on this podcast because so many of the cult movies we look at are old enough to be super problematic upon re-reviewing them. And I would say The Warriors actually isn't as problematic as I thought it might be. You know, I think in many ways, one of the things that I think is very kind of progressive for when it came out is sort of the integrated style of race in the film and the way that they sort of, I don't know, there's sort of this level playing field where you've got, you know, Black folks, white folks, Latin folks, you know, and there's not as much racism as you would expect from a movie made in 1979 about a group of gangs in New York City. Yeah.
Right. It was about what gang you're in, not what you look like or who you are. Yeah.
One thing that I wanted to bring up, because we talked about sort of the comic book structure of this movie, or even the fantasy or the time out of joint conceit of this movie. And one of the things that really lends itself to that, that I don't hear enough people talk about, but that I really love, and maybe it's just because I'm sitting in front of a giant microphone as I'm about to bring it up, are the inner cuts at the radio station of just these beautiful, luscious lips reporting on what's going on. And the idea that there's this late night gang radio reporting to you what's going on out there on the mean streets. What's your take on that? Do you like that?
I kind of love it. I'm kind of obsessed with it a little bit. And I love that she's like, hey, all you boppers. I'm like, that is so cool. She's just so cool. And I actually really like that it's mostly close-ups. We never really see her full face, do we?
No, we don't. Never.
I love that. I think that was a really cool element of filmmaking where it kind of brings you into the warrior's world of they're not seeing what she looks like either, and neither are we. We just know that she's this fabulous woman with nice lips and she just sounds really cool. And that's all that really the warriors or the gangs kind of, or anyone listening would know. I was big into the Rocky Horror Picture Show growing up. Like I played Janet, I did all that stuff. I kind of feel like the weirdness of this movie is almost like the macho kind of version in a way of a Rocky type vibe energy. Like I feel like if you could, how would you do a shadow cast of all these gangs in a subway? But I would go. If that were to happen, I would go.
You'd have to have a shadow cast who is really good at quick costume changes.
Yes.
Yes. But I think it could be done. That's the business I'm in. So, you know, I love a challenge and I'm like, okay, we've got 12 people. We're going to do this. I agree with you that the lips and that character,
tricksy. It's like the opening credits of double feature picture show. It's the lips.
Yeah, exactly. Like we never know whose lips those are either. You know,
right.
They float from outer space and they sing, you know, it's Patricia Quinn's lips. We know later singing, lip syncing to Richard O'Brien's voice. And it's just perfect for that film. And I think with the Warriors, it's another New York moment as well, because it reminded me of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, where you've got a DJ and it all takes place on this one day, this hot, hot summer day, you know, in Brooklyn. And the DJ's kind of giving you updates throughout the day. And I was thinking about like New York, radio in New York, especially at this time in the late 70s and the 80s. Huge. I mean, it was very important, you know, locally, you know, everyone listened to the radio. So I love this device because it's sort of, well, it's also a fantasy because how is she getting the intel that she's getting?
Yeah.
Right.
And we never actually see anyone listening to a radio. So how are they hearing it?
Yeah.
She's like the narrator almost. Yeah. The magical kind of, like, you know, in Nightmare Before Christmas, where you have that opening scene and that this really cool booming voice is just like, and then we have this. It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I wonder how the actor felt if they told her, like, oh, by the way, like, it's an extreme close up on your lips and we're never actually going to see you. It's so effective for the film. But, you know, there is part of me that's like, oh, it might have been nice for her, you know, to have a right. wider shot. But yeah, she does an incredible job. And it also is just such a great device because to have this work, they needed a way to explain how these gangs were getting this information.
Right.
And, you know, that's the only way it really kind of made sense.
And as a point of interest for listeners and children of the 90s, those lips and the actress they belong to were Lynn Thigpen, who you may know if you grew up watching Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, the game show, because she was the chief.
Too old.
Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Yeah, she was the chief. Remember at the beginning and end of every episode? That's her.
No idea.
Oh, you just blew my mind. That is so cool.
And that will mean something to some of our listeners, Peaches.
Yeah. I'm sure it will. Clearly, I think I was probably too old when that show was popular.
It had a kick-ass a cappella theme song.
Oh,
that's
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Oh, yeah.
Well, speaking of performances, since we're highlighting some of these performances that might maybe don't often get highlighted, one that I really wanted to recognize was Luther and Patrick Kelly, who plays Luther. I feel like that is one of the best performances in the whole film. Like, just such a maniac and so wild,
unhinged.
Yes.
Yeah. When they're like, why'd you do it? When he didn't really have an answer. I believed him. I'm like, I think he just did it because he's Luther. I don't know.
He had like a sort of a Charles Manson look and he was little. And right at the beginning, when he turns and kind of says, you know, it was the Warriors, you know, and he goes running at the guy, you're like, oh my God, like you're a nightmare. That scene where they're buying the, they're at the sort of bodega or the newspaper stand and stealing the candy from the girl. And he throws I don't know if he throws money at her or what he throws at her, but like, he's just so scary and so good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like, are you going to pay for that? And clearly he's not. Good luck.
Right. Right.
Well, now that we're highlighting performances, Samantha, are there any other characters in this movie that really always stand out to you?
I mean, if you're going to talk about Luther, obviously the one line that people who've never even seen the Warriors, like, of course, you know, everyone. And the bottle, I want to know, what I'm curious about is I wonder if the director was like, hey, try and put these bottles and put them together and let's make this creepy weird. Or if he just improvised that, you know, like, I wonder if that was him. It's kind of like, you know, in Silence of the Lambs, when you find out that Buffalo Bill, like, that was an improv, with the dancing and the kimono and the way he talks, like, that wasn't in the script.
I didn't know that.
And that's like the most iconic, people just remember that. So I wonder what the case was, because it was so brilliant and creepy the way he did it. I would love to know more about that backstory.
The movie is shot beautifully, like so beautiful. A low budget film that was shooting. And apparently one of the challenges they had was there were four other films shooting that summer in New York City. And this was the lowest budget of all four. So all the crew, all the union folks, all the other people were, you know, basically working on the other projects. It's one of those classic stories of a movie succeeding against all odds, which often is what happens when you're challenged. And they definitely shot a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. And then the editing of it, the way it's put together, and that one sequence that you're talking about, where you hear the glass bottles clinking. And I remember thinking, like, upon rewatching it, like, as I knew what was coming, because I'd seen the movie before, I was like, wow, that is so disturbing. You don't know if it's part of the soundtrack. You don't know where it's coming from. It's just unsettling. And then eventually, finally, it cuts to him and you see him with the, you know, the three bottles in his hand. Genius.
I never thought of this until just now, but it's like, you know, in Nightmare on Elm Street, when you just hear the glove like screeching against the metal, that's kind of the same effect.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. For sure. Oh, that's so great. Yeah. It's a great movie. I mean, it's definitely one now because of you that I'm not going to wait another 20 years to watch again. Like, I'm going to seek out a screening. In fact, I love that you saw it in a graveyard, because that whole sequence in the park, in the graveyard.
Oh, they hide in a graveyard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was like, this is meant to be.
Yeah.
To mention performances, though, really quick, another warrior specifically that I just fell in love with is the young guy.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
So like, oh God. Okay. Yeah. You just, your heart, like, I don't know if it's maybe my maternal instinct, which I never thought I'd have ever. But I'm like, I want to keep that kid safe. I want to make sure that he makes it back.
Well, you know that he is also the only one who doesn't fall for the Lizzie's trap. Like, he's nervous the whole time. And I read it's partially because that actor was openly gay. And Walter Hill just allowed that to like manifest in the character as well.
Oh, I so like, that.
And I think that's amazing.
How is it that I fall in love with the one gay man? Of course I did. That's that is so on brand for me.
I need to go see this with an audience, you know, again. And my friend Heclina, who's a drag love performer. Yeah, really? You do?
you more, obviously.
Thank you. Of course. Goes without saying. So she is obsessed with this movie. And, you know, we did another movie that she's obsessed with, probably the other one that she's most obsessed with, which is Rock and Roll High School. And funnily enough, this movie, The Warriors, not that I'm comparing the two, because you don't need to compare them, but this is the one where I'm like, God, I wish I'd just gone to see it with her. I remember her being like, The Warriors is playing at the Castro. Let's go see it. Me being like, The Warriors, I don't know. And now I'm like, Jesus, I missed out. You know, I want to see it on the big screen. That scene where the Furies are running, chasing them, that chase sequence. Oh my God, it's gorgeous. Right.
Why are people not tapping into this for Halloween costumes more often? I was watching this and I was like, I want to be a Fury. Like, I mean, that's so cool.
Right? 100%. It's interesting that you mentioned the comic book part, because it kind of almost, now it's making me think of like The Walking Dead, how that was a comic. And then it created these like kind of iconic characters, and they all have a really cool look. Yeah. And all of the different, same with Walking Dead, there's like different gangs of people who are staying together to survive, you know, and they all have a different kind of a dress code in a way.
I would not be surprised if Robert Kirkman, creator of The Walking Dead, who's very tapped into pop culture, didn't pull on the Warriors a little bit. Seems very up his alley.
Even Michonne with the headband. That's like the red headband. That's hello.
Exactly. All right. Well, as we're wrapping up, a question that I usually ask everybody is about the trajectory that we have with cult films. Now, you saw this movie at a screening in the cemetery.
Right.
And that, I assume, was not too terribly long ago, because a lot of people discover cult films in their childhood. But you saw this a little bit later in life.
I was a grown ass woman.
But from that initial screening to now, you're kind of living with your love of the Warriors. How has your relationship with this movie changed, if at all?
So when I saw it, I was super into it, but obviously there were distractions. I was going to meet up with this guy, so I still was a little nervous about how it was going to go. And it was in June, but it was really cold that night. So it's one of those like, oh, this is really good, but also, do you have a blanket? And for whatever reason, I didn't rewatch it again until years later. I think it was just playing on Sundance or IFC or something. And I remember just my instinct, because I was flipping through like, oh, what should I record to watch later? And I immediately was like, Warriors, click, record. You know, and then I rewatched it and I was like, wow, this is really cool. But I kind of rewatched it with it in the background. I don't know why, because I like to have stuff playing in the background if I'm writing or I'm doing something. But it wasn't until the time after that that I was like, you know what? Sit down and watch this for real, that I fell in love with it even harder, because I was able to really, I already had an appreciation. Like, I already know I like this movie, so I'm already invested. But let me really pay attention. And I loved it. And then I just watched it a couple days ago to prepare again for this. And the first word out of my mouth, as soon as it started playing, I fucking love this movie. You know, and it just, that's really how I felt. as soon as I put it on, like, I am going to have a next good couple of hours. It's going to be good.
I love that.
I really, really relate. And I can't thank you enough for suggesting the movie, because I feel like it's like, okay, this movie I've known about. I mean, I'm in the business of cult movies. That's what I do. And this is one of the most important cult films that I've maybe slept on a little bit. So thank you for bringing the Warriors back into my life and really kind of igniting a new love affair with a movie that I wish I had paid more attention to. So yeah, thank you so much.
I feel the same way. I mean, I don't know how, Michael, I don't know how we got talking about it somehow. I don't know, but I feel like it was meant to be. It was just meant to come up, because we were talking about horror films. We weren't even talking about anything outside of that genre, really. But Warriors are just like, nope, we're here, we're coming through.
We had been talking because I knew that I wanted to have Samantha on the show, and we were talking about horror movies, obviously, because of Horror Nerd. Right. And then I think you just said something about the Warriors in passing, and you know how sometimes when the stars align, those words hit, and I was just like, the Warriors. And I emailed Peaches, and I was like, what about the Warriors? And it just, you set us on this path, and I'm so glad, like Josh, like Peaches said, I am so glad that you brought this to us, because I don't want to wait another great amount of years to keep celebrating this film.
I could not agree more. I really do think that's right. The stars just aligned. It just was meant to come out. Why did I mention it in past? I don't know. I just mentioned it. I don't know. I mean, and now we've all gotten to re-fall in love with it, which is really cool. And now, I mean, I'm literally going to buy it as soon as I hang up with you guys and just watch it on a plane. Next time I'm on a plane, you know, it's going to be like that movie that you're just like, oh, this just makes me feel good when I watch it. Now I can get through this plane trip with the screaming baby or whatever.
And also, there's nothing better than watching a slightly weird movie on a plane and having the person next to you looking at you like, what is going on?
100%. It's my favorite thing to do. I'm like, oh, the weirder the better. Oh, is there like a nice little family? Sit with me. Come on over. I'm putting on Halloween. Has your baby seen it? Well, they will now.
Oh, that's perfect. Well, we encourage all the listeners to go and see you anywhere they can. But of course, especially, you know, I'm going to make a point of coming to your horror comedy show. Like, there's no way I'm missing that. I will be there. Michael, we're going to go together.
Yes.
Please. Oh, my God. That'd be amazing. That would be amazing.
I'm assuming that listeners can find you on Instagram and Twitter. I know that I follow you on Twitter now, and Facebook and all of that.
I have to say, when I saw that you started following me on Instagram, I was like, ooh, hello. Oh my God. I totally felt really cool for that. So thank you for that. But yeah, I'm on Instagram and Twitter at the Samantha Hale. I'm not trying to be like a douche with the, apparently there's another account. So I don't know.
I have the same problem. I'm Peaches Christ because someone took Peaches Christ. It's like, yeah, it does seem like we're kind of like the Samantha Hale, Peaches Christ. You know. But no, just because some shithead took our name. That's why.
Completely. Yeah. We should hack him.
Yeah,
we should.
Meanwhile, that's what the real estate agent Michael Verratti is saying about me.
Well done.
All right. Well, thank you, Samantha.
Thank you. This was so fun. I could have talked about this movie for another 3 hours.
That was the fabulous, the hilarious, the wonderful Samantha Hale. I know that you've had the pleasure of attending her horror comedy show, but I'm going to do it because, yeah, that just sounds too perfect. And I'm so glad that Samantha suggested we do The Warriors. Thank you, Samantha.
She discovered this movie at a screening at the cemetery here in Hollywood, and it was on the same night that she was kind of sort of hung up on some guy that she was supposed to go on a date with, but ended up finding a cult movie that she kept. And the guy, well, she didn't.
Let's face it. Dick comes and goes.
But cult movies are forever.
Cult movies are forever. I have had only maybe 100 cult movies in my life that I've fallen in love with. That's special. Compared to the thousands and thousands of men I've slept with.
Thousands. and thousands.
Anyway, yeah, no, that was fabulous. The thing of it's not too late, I think, is so great in regards to Samantha, because when you think about the cult movie fanatic for the Warriors, I think maybe our next guest is probably what is more popular. A young man discovered it at a young age, really connected with it, you know, has had a long history with it. Meanwhile, Samantha, you know, discovered it all these years later, randomly, didn't even seek it out, you know, just happened to be at a screening because of a date kind of gone wrong. It's fabulous, you know, and here she is, you know, then suggesting it for us to cover and being a guest and celebrating it with us years later.
Yeah. And it takes me back all the way to the second episode of this podcast when we had Phil Nobile Jr. from Fangoria on, and we were talking about Phantom of the Paradise. Because one of the things we discussed with Phil was this idea that cults that surround cult films do have a limited shelf life, because eventually the people who are interested in the movies will get older, or, you know, pop culture will move on or whatever. But something that we unpacked with him in that discussion that I think is proving true with this Warriors discussion is that that's true, but it's also not. As long as there's someone waving the banner for a cult film, whether it's Phantom of the Paradise, Vegas in Space, The Warriors, etc., and they're out there worshiping at its altar, and it catches the attention of someone else, whether it be through a screening, through a podcast, through word of mouth, then maybe, just maybe, that cult film will find a new audience and live on. And I think that one of the great joys here of us doing Midnight Mass now two seasons in is we not only get to celebrate movies that we love, but every so often we'll get emails from people who say, well, I've never seen Blood Diner, or I had never seen The Baby, and you introduced me to this movie, or I always meant to watch The Bad Seed. We always meant to watch The Warriors. And now look at the celebration. And if we have contributed anything to the world, that's something I'm very grateful that we have gotten to do.
I agree completely. We're just in this unique position now, thanks to the listeners, to have a platform. I hate that word, but we have a platform. I'm on a platform right now. But if I could use this platform to help turn on people to these movies, these gems, whether you're discovering them for the first time or rediscovering them or just celebrating them with us, then that to me is like a reason for us to do this podcast. And also just the fact that you and I just are such dorks that we actually just love talking about movies. And what's funny is even when we're not doing the podcast, we're talking about movies. So we're those kind of people. So, you know.
Speaking of someone who uses their platform to celebrate the movies of yesteryear, our next guest has utilized a lot of his writing and podcasting career celebrating the catalog of Hammer Films and reintroducing the legacy of Britain's most famous horror film studio to a new audience. He also happens to be a huge, huge fan of The Warriors. So when I knew we were doing this episode, I reached out to him. He was very, very excited to talk about it. And he got a break from talking about Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing to come chat with us about this movie he loves. It's Paul Farrell, and we're talking to him right now. Welcome back, boppers. It's been a long night. And while Peaches and I were able to dodge Heklina and her gang of ruffians at the subway station, we still have some miles to go. Luckily, we've run into another friend on the way in the form of our next guest. A veritable scholar of fright, you can routinely find his byline in publications such as Bloody Disgusting and Scriptophobics. What's more, he's the co-host of Dead Ringers, a twice-monthly horror podcast about double features with shared DNA but distinct personalities. And that's not all. He pulls double duty as the co-host of the Screamatics Hammer Pub podcast, which explores the depths of the legendary Hammer Studios film catalog, offering feature-length commentary and delightful insight in the process. As a side note, I learned recently that I am one of Hammer Pub's most recurring guests, so I think that confirms the alcohol they drink over there has definitely impaired their judgment. But seriously, I'm so happy he could join us to chat this rough and tumble cult classic. Please welcome writer, host, and genre bon vivant, Paul Farrell. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here. And thank you for such a wonderful introduction. It made me feel better about myself just hearing it.
Well, why don't we leap into it? Because I happen to know that you love this movie, but where does the love affair start? When did you first discover The Warriors?
So for me, I caught it on, I believe it was TNT as a kid. I was channel searching on a Saturday afternoon, and I all of a sudden saw this giant crowd of people, throngs of people kind of gathered around the speaker. And the guy was screaming, "Can you dig it?" And I was probably 9 or 10, and I just got drawn in, and it was unlike anything I had ever seen before. I was a pretty sheltered movie watcher growing up. You mentioned I'm on a lot of horror podcasts. I'm one of the rare horror people who didn't watch every horror movie growing up. In fact, most of them I didn't catch until like college. But I did become a bit of an action aficionado because of The Warriors and because of TNT and USA and the TV stations that would sort of edit the movies in a way where I was allowed to watch them. My parents didn't have to freak out. And so, yeah, I would watch it when it was on. Eventually, I recorded it on VHS, became just sort of one of those like Friday night I would put it on type of movies, and just kind of fell in love with it.
I hadn't thought of the genre until just now, which is so interesting to me. I'm like, action movie. I guess it is an action movie. He's right. And it has the tropes and everything, but typically that's not a genre that I was ever very, drawn to. However, I can think of many quote unquote action movies I've enjoyed over the years. It's just not something I necessarily thought of when thinking about The Warriors. And now that you say that, I'm like, yeah, it's like an elevated in my mind action movie. Yeah. I don't know. It's like so good that I almost don't want to call it an action movie, which is bizarre.
Yeah, what I loved about it was it's such a simple movie, right? Like it's very boiled down to its core elements. And later, like as I got older and eventually went and watched like The Driver, it was very clear why this was such a good fit for Walter Hill and, how this kind of speaks to what he does. But yeah, action films a lot of times do get very convoluted with plot and, just set piece after set piece. But this is a movie that felt a little bit more like a video game to me, especially video games at that time where it was like side scrollers, Street Fighter. You go from this level, you beat these guys. You go to this level, you beat these guys. And I could wrap my mind around that as a kid. And it became, I liked the feel of how that sort of went. And then eventually, as I got older, I was able to kind of see a little bit more into it. Like as a teenager, I was like, oh, this is really interesting that the gangs in this movie, that's just sort of their world. It isn't viewed as, oh, these people are bad and shouldn't be in gangs and we need to sort of help them and fix them. It's more like, no, this is the world they live in. This is who they are. We're not passing judgment. We're just telling a story within that world. And I kind of appreciated that too, that it wasn't looking in through this lens and trying to pass judgment on these people. It was more, hey, this is just a variation on the world and let's see what kind of happens there. So that was something too that I think got more interesting as I got older. So that's one of the reasons I think The Warriors stayed with me, is that I was able to evolve with it. Even though it's very simple, it has a lot going on.
Well, you mentioned the simplicity of the movie, and that's something I want to dig into, because I'm wondering if that in the long run is what has lent itself to becoming a cult film, because we look at this kind of dystopian world where everyone is in a gang. And just as you said, it's not convoluted. We go from this gang to this gang to this gang till Coney yeah. Island. One thing that really never occurred to me until reflecting back on the movie is we never see anyone in the New York of this movie that isn't part of a gang. Like, we don't see normal citizens, except for maybe the girl working at the newsstand. End of list, yeah. Right? Everyone else is aligned with some sort of mythical group. Yeah. And do you think that that is why this movie has such appeal? Because in a way, it's simply structured, but mythical in presentation.
Cult movies in general have a mythology to them typically, right? If not in the movie, one that is eventually constructed around them, right? It's either projected onto them or it's there to begin with. And I think this movie gives you all the blueprints of a cult classic and lets the audience kind of fill in the blanks as time goes by. There's a pageantry to this movie. A subgenre, a genre I was really into as a kid. This is, again, not my typical MO, but I was a big musical guy. Like, I loved musicals as a kid growing up. And so I kind of look back on it and I'm like, oh, that's probably why I like The Warriors so much, because it kind of feels like a musical. You know, the score is this like driving force that's constantly propelling the characters and the action forward. You know, the costuming, like, you know, I love the baseball furies and just the elaborate makeup and costuming they're wearing. It's just so striking, and the choreography of the fights, it doesn't really feel, I don't know, I never felt the same sort of fear I necessarily would feel in like a more hardcore actioner or horror movie where there's that kind of fighting. In this, it was more just kind of fun and not silly, but there was an excitement to it that didn't strike the same chord, you know, that I was used to when seeing that type of action. I think it's because it feels more choreographed. I do think, you know, I know that was sort of a roundabout way of getting to your question, but yeah, I do think that that's all kind of why this movie has become the cult classic that it is.
I think you're hitting on so many interesting things that we, Michael and I have, I think, shared a fondness for, but haven't really totally articulated yet. One is bringing up your fondness for musicals, because this is sort of one song shy of being West Side Story, right? Like, it basically is, you know, it is West Side Story in some ways, right? It's just, you know, a different, you know, there's a love story component and there's you know, the gangs, of course, and it's New York. And it's this mythology that you speak of that I think is sometimes hard for us to put our finger on the pulse of. And we talked about this actually in our Little Shop of Horrors episode as well, where it is this sort of fantastical version of New York. And like Michael mentioned, everyone in this movie is in a gang. And that's very kind of appealing, because you mentioned, I think astutely, that there's no judgment in that world because everyone is in this world. So it's not about gangs are good or bad. It's about this is who we are and this is the world we live in. And this is the obstacles we have to face, which leads me to circle way back to something you said earlier on, which really hit me over the head, which is it is like a video game. It is a movie that's a video game. And in fact, now I have to ask you, since the movie came out and it became popular, they did make a video game, right? And then they put out comic books, you know, after the movie was successful. So were you a fan of the Warriors video game? I mean, I'm not a video game person, but I know enough about video games to know that this movie is like a video game.
I did play it. I had it in, gosh, I don't know when it came out, early 2000s, mid 2000s. And it had a lot of the original cast come back and do voices and stuff, which that was why it appealed to me at the time. I was like, oh, I was in college and, you know, it just, as a Warriors fan, I saw that they were doing a lot of that. They made like a Ghostbusters game and got the original cast back for that. That was sort of a thing they were kind of doing at the time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I liked the game. They also eventually, I think, made like a side-scrolling version, which almost makes more sense to me. Yeah, like they made sort of a, you know, like retro gaming is sort of becoming popular.
You have to explain that to the video game idiot.
Like if you think back to like really early video games like Mario Brothers or something, where he's just walking straight across a screen.
Got it.
That's sort of, you know, and they used to have fighting games like Street Fighter and like Battletoads and stuff, where they would like walk across. They did a sort of an app-based version of that with the Warriors at one point, which feels almost like more attuned to kind of what the Warriors is than making a little bit more of like a three-dimensional open-y world type game. I used to be a lot more into gaming than I am now. Like, once I sort of had kids, it was like, okay, I never have time to do any of that anymore, sadly. But yeah, I did play it, and I did enjoy it. I never read the comics. That was something I didn't really get into, but I did play the game. I liked that, and you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, what's interesting when you think of this movie in the context of a video game or a comic book or an action movie where we have the hero's journey, and it's truly a hero's journey. They start in the Bronx and they have to get back to Coney Island. What I think is interesting about this particular film is that while, yes, there is zero judgment about everyone in this universe belonging to this gang or that gang, whatever, kind of this chosen family structure, one thing that I think is really significant about the Warriors, and specifically the Warriors themselves, is that they're not without reproach. Like, the characters are culpable for their own bad behavior, and the movie kind of holds them to task. And this is something we sort of talked about with Samantha, our other guest. But the idea that Swan, Michael Beck's character, he's kind of shitty a little bit at certain points to our lead female. And even James Remar's character with sort of the language he uses and how he gets hauled in, and he's the one who gets hauled in for it. And I'm wondering if part of what sells this world is that our heroes aren't always heroic.
I do agree. And I liked that there were consequences to those things too. You know, I was somebody that when I would, even as a kid, I was always a big movie fan, you know, growing up, even though I wasn't allowed to watch a lot of movies and I didn't have any, like my parents never bought VHSs. So like what I watched was what I could rent or what was on TV.
Right.
And I always gravitated towards stuff where, yeah, like if something, there had to be stakes. Like, it always bothered me when everyone was okay and there were no real problems. Like, you know, I needed that sort of justice to be present in the film. So for like the Ajax character, I remember the first time I was watching it, weirdly, like I can remember that day. And I remember being like really angry at the Ajax character throughout the film. And when he finally does get held accountable, specifically after attempting to do something more horrible than I realized at the age that I was seeing it, you know, I was just like, oh, he's attacking that woman. That's horrible. You know, I didn't even get the implications of what that really was. And every time as I got older, rewatching the movie, it was sort of more like the fact that that ramification was on the horizon made it easier to sort of digest his problematic nature earlier in the film. And in regards to how he also treats like Swan, like he doesn't trust Swan's leadership. You know, there's sort of fighting within the ranks. Swan is obviously insecure about that, you know, on top of everything else. So it's like, he's not this, like you said, infallible person who just, I don't care what people think. I'm just going to do what I know is right. He's not that guy. Right. It's weird. As heightened as the world is and as sort of mythological, there's still a raw realism to the characters and a lot of what they're going through. There's a DIY nature to kind of the characterizations and some of the writing that I feel like it makes it all so much more relatable and easier to care about overall. And what might otherwise feel like too simple of a movie in some ways, like if the characters didn't have any depth or weren't complex in any way, the simplicity might hurt the overall experience.
Yeah.
As movie lovers, as genre fans, as cult movie obsessed people, especially as horror fans, there are a lot of movies that I'm really, really fond of that I haven't seen in 20, 30 years. And, you know, rewatching them, sometimes I'm a little disappointed. Other times, things that I sort of liked but didn't really watch repeatedly, including The Warriors and Little Shop of Horrors, I've had the absolute pleasure of rewatching because I know they are cult and we're going to tackle them on this show, and then seeing them through whatever, maybe with more experience or just a different set of eyes, I'm like, holy shit, this movie's so amazing. And that's how The Warriors hit me. And I think what you just described, it's that mix of like the costumes are so over the top. They're so surreal. They're so fabulous and sort of ridiculous in a way that I really, really applaud, you know, especially The Warriors. Those leather vests are just so fabulous. You know, when she wants one of the leather vests, I'm like, you know, yeah, Mercy, I want one too. You know, who wouldn't want one of those? So you've got this sort of basically camp level of mythology going on in this universe where everyone's in a gang and they're wearing these insane costumes and makeup. I mean, full drag faces for the Furies, you know, men in makeup, like just wonderfully camp. But the performances and the writing are set to such a realistic tone that it really makes this movie special in a really unique way. And I think you're really speaking to that. Like, it has a very unique tone and style that honestly, without a great director, you know, someone who was really controlling that vision, because it's consistent from start to finish. It doesn't waver.
Yeah.
You know, it knows what it is. I mean, I love that scene with the Lizzies where you're kind of hoping they're going to fucking, you know, go nuts. And they do, you know, but they didn't put the Lizzies in campy costumes like that. Those sorts of decisions make this movie, I think, elevated to just a smarter degree than most movies.
Yeah. Well, and I like that you brought up the Lizzies, because that's another thing I really appreciate about the movie, is that right after the scene where, you know, Ajax, you know, attempts to take advantage of a woman and is arrested, we then see the rest of the Warriors basically, maybe not as violently doing it, but kind of doing a similar thing where they see a bunch of women. They're like, oh, here's an in for us. Let's take a break from all this fighting and go enjoy ourselves. And, you know, something obviously feels off about it to the viewer, like, because this is the next level and you guys aren't. So it almost feels like a situation where the movie wants you to know, like, you know, this is their next sort of battle, but they're not smart enough or intuitive enough or, you know, whatever you want to say to sort of grasp it. And in a way, they kind of deserve it, you know, because they're not thinking with their heads, and they're essentially they're not providing the agency to these women that they should, and they have to answer to that. And I think that a lot of other movies of this ilk wouldn't go that far with it or do something as intelligent with it. Like you said, they would have potentially put them in, you know, costuming that was more exploitative, or who knows. But ultimately, that's something that Walter Hill does so well in so many of his movies. And, you know, I always think of this like sort of a brother sister relationship to Streets of Fire. You know, it has a lot in common with that. And I think that movie also does some really similar things, obviously, albeit in a more heightened way, but.
Well, and that's the musical, right? I mean,
right. That's the musical Warriors. Right?
And it's funny that you mention it. And of course, I think it's natural that we end up on Streets of Fire a little bit, because if you had asked me all the way back at the beginning of Midnight Mass, which Walter Hill movie we would have landed on first, I actually would have always thought it would have been Streets of Fire.
Yeah.
But I think that it's good that we arrived there via the Warriors, and we'll get to Streets of Fire later. Because you're right, I think they inform each other in a really interesting way. One thing I wanted to bring up that we haven't had a chance to talk about with either of our guests so far, you talk about Warriors entering to their actions and suffering the consequences of their actions. And one thing that happens quite quickly and then is forgotten is the one Warrior who kind of just falls on the subway tracks and is never discussed again. I just wanted to throw that out there, because they don't seem too busted up that one of their number just kind of gets like creamed by the A train.
It's funny you bring that up, because, you know, over the years being a fan of this movie, I, and you know, you've been on Hammer Pub. I'm very obsessed with like behind the scenes stuff and like how a movie got made. That always really interests me. And that was Fox, and Thomas Waits played him, and he was somebody that, had a very contentious relationship with Walter Hill. What ended up happening was they started out, Hill tried to sort of befriend him and be his sort of mentor. Waits kind of rejected that relationship, and it got really bad on set. And it got basically to the point where Hill brought over the choreographer and said, "We need to kill this character. He needs to be off this movie. I don't care how you do it." And Waits like refused to do the scene. So if you actually watch the scene where he dies, it's all the stunt coordinator, and his face is never really facing the camera. So that was sort of a impromptu decision. I suppose a fault with the movie in a way, because obviously that you can tell that it wasn't part of the trajectory of the script, certainly. Like, the story doesn't really call for it, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I suppose, you know, as a kid, it added stakes. Like I said, it was like, oh shit, like any of these people could die at any time, you know?
For the most random reason. I mean, that's the other thing about it. It doesn't, did you know the answer, Michael?
I did, but okay.
I figured that was like a prompt.
Of course, but I would assume that Michael would know, because Michael's like you, Paul. He knows these things and he does the deeper dives into stuff. And I typically don't. I'm not very much of a trivia person. However, because of rewatching the movie and preparing for our show, that was a question I had. And I mean, it did not take me long to figure it out, because it does not feel right. Like Paul said, it does not. Now, I hadn't really thought about the stunt double, but that makes total sense. But that whole thing does not feel right. And I got there, if you Google it, listeners at home, or look for the answer, there is, at least what I was able to find really pretty easily, an interview with Walter Hill, who basically just says, like, I could not deal with this guy. You know, he was driving me nuts. Yeah. And I mean, as someone who's directed a movie, can I just tell you how fucking happy that made me? Let me just say, actors know the power they wield once they've shot a certain amount of footage. Can I just, do we all understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So they do have a certain kind of control over the set in some ways. And I just love that Walter Hill was like, fuck you. We're throwing you in front of a subway. You're done.
Right.
Oh, it's amazing.
I mean, it's one way to handle it. No, I did know the secret behind that scene, but it is interesting, Paul, you're right, because I think everything else about this script, simple though it may be, is accounted for other than that.
Yeah.
Despite Ajax's infractions, once he disappears from the movie, there's still sort of a line of questioning. What happened to Ajax? But we never really get that. Like, no one ever is like, what happened to Fox? Like, no one's really concerned that their, like, buddy just got, like, creamed by the fucking railway system, the MTA, you know?
Also, how lucky for them that they shot in such a way. As you know, making movies is very complicated. You do not shoot them in order, you know? So it's just wild to me that they were able to shoot enough of him to kill him off, you know, so early on and be okay with it, you know? Or maybe they went back and shot some scenes later that he was in, because I would imagine he was in some stuff that they shot that happened later in the movie. Well, who knows? I don't know. But the filmmaker in me is going like, can you really do this? Can you get away with just killing an actor? You know,
can you dig it?
I dig it. Oh, I dig it. That's fabulous.
It feels like a testament to the sort of guerrilla style production this movie had too, because it was very rough and tumble. You know, it was, because not only did they have to get permits, you know, just regular permits to shoot in New York, they had to like carry cash around to pay off like actual gangs that were roaming the streets at night and, you know, throwing bricks at them and doing other things, so it sounds like a kind of a wild production in general,
which I would expect nothing less from Walter Hill. Now, speaking of gangs, which of course is what the movie is about, and you've already spoken to this a little bit, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask. We asked our other guests this as well, and even if the answer is obvious, I want to put this question to you. Outside of the Warriors themselves, do you have a favorite gang in the movie?
I mean, mine's, I kind of mentioned it before, but Baseball Furies is mine. I know that's probably the obvious answer, but
right.
Just since I was a kid, that was the one that I immediately latched on. I was like, oh, that's so cool.
I think I'm going to do a Baseball Fury for
Now I'm thinking Peaches as a Baseball Fury.
No, you said something else. You have to stick to your guns. I'm going to go back and I'm going to hold you accountable on this. There's anyway, more than one look.
I was going to say, that's the beautiful thing about it. There's a bunch of Baseball Furies.
That's true, Michael. We could both do it. And I could just be the glamazon femme one.
Right. You could wear like a baseball. Oh, it could be like a League of Their Own meets Baseball Furies.
Totally. But with their sort of, you know, stripes and the whole thing.
Exactly.
And then I would have a baseball bat coming out of my asshole. So I would be part popsicle.
There it is. And you can see this look when Peaches and I present the Warriors for a Halloween screening at theaters. Give us money to do this.
Oh my God. I remember the other thing amazing. I was going to be was Tar Man.
Oh, that's what it was.
I was going to be Tar Woman. And I'm sitting here wearing a Tar Man shirt. Oh my God. Now I have to decide between being Tar Woman or female baseball fury. Mm. I don't know. It's tough.
Paul, the other favorite amongst the Midnight Mass crew. We love the mimes that we see at the beginning of the movie and never really get to see again.
Mimes are good.
I'm kind of obsessed with this like kung fu gang that exists that like are right out of the pages of like a Jim Kelly, like Soul Cinema kung fu movie. Cause they are in like serious numbers. That's like a huge, huge group.
I still wish they had put all of the one gang in roller skates, you know, instead of the baseball furies get the most over the top costume and everyone loves them. You know, Paul, do you own the poster?
I have like a closet of posters right now that I need to like frame and put up. And
it's God, you have to let them out of the closet.
No, I know. It's terrible.
Pride month, honey. but the baseball furies on the poster were always, you know, as a kid, that was the thing that I always noticed the most. Yeah. So, Paul, have you done any cosplay for the Warriors?
I did do a Baseball Fury costume as a kid, and nobody got it. Nobody understood. They're just like, are you, so you're a baseball player? You know, I'm like, no, I'm a Baseball Fury, you know, anyway. And I, you know, it was homemade. So, and, you know, it was probably not the most realistic screen. And that's really the extent of it. I haven't dabbled in the cosplay world. I did dress up as Marty McFly once for a convention.
All right.
But that's about as far as I've gotten. I haven't gotten to the Warriors full on yet as an adult. I have to do that.
Oh, God. You know, when we do our Warriors screening, that's what we have to do. We have to encourage people to come with their friends.
Yeah, I would totally
dress make up their own new gang. You know, like show up as your
own.
That's
a good idea.
Like with a name, and that'll be the contest. So it's not like an individual costume contest. It's like a costume contest where 5 to 10 to a dozen people get on stage at the same time. Ooh, I love that.
I gotta say, we keep threatening that we're gonna do this screening. We may have to actually do this screening.
I want to do a screening for every movie we tackle. Almost, you know.
It's true.
Yeah. This would be a screening I would have to travel for, I think. I hear about the screenings that y'all do, and I'm always like, oh, someday I'm going to get to one of these. And if you did a Warriors one, that might
Where are you?
I'm in St. Louis.
Oh, home of Trans World. But for many years, I was going to Trans World. And for the listeners who think they know what Trans World is, because they say Peaches Christ is going to a convention called Trans World. It's not what you think, actually. It's the world's largest haunters convention is held in St. Louis.
I didn't know that.
That's you didn't?
I didn't know that.
Oh my God, Paul, you have to come with me. It's amazing.
I have to go. Yeah, I would love to go to that.
Yeah, it's called Trans World.
Okay.
It's the haunted attractions. You're supposed, I don't know if it's still like this, but before you had to have industry credentials, but you know, I can say that you work with my haunted attraction and
us. I would love to do that. Just drop me a line if that is ever a possibility. Yeah. I grew up in Chicago. So like, I don't know as much about St. Louis and I'm learning. So I'm learning every day.
We're going to go to Trans World.
Okay. I'm excited.
Okay. So Paul, bringing it back to the Warriors, the star of the Warriors, Michael Beck, famously is the star of 2 tentpole cult films, like on 2 very different ends of the spectrum, The Warriors and Xanadu. So between The Warriors and Xanadu, which movie goes harder on roller skates?
Ooh, I guess Xanadu.
I think this question to you because you like musicals.
So I do. Well, that's the thing. Xanadu goes pretty hard on roller skates. I mean, that's, you know, Warriors handles roller skates, but I think it takes half measures with roller skates. Like, as we said, we don't get a full roller skating gang. And even when we do, I don't think we get enough roller skating fight action. Like I would have wanted a little bit more of that to take down Xanadu for that title. Xanadu really.
Let's be fair. ONJ and the roller skating muses would probably F up the Warriors if they had to.
I think they would. I think in a street brawl, I would give them the edge personally.
So, all right. One of the questions I like to ask as we're wrapping up, you saw this movie on TNT the first time. Yeah. And you have dressed as a baseball fury for Halloween. You have the poster stored somewhere in the closet. It's waiting to come out. But you have lived with this movie for most of your life. How has your relationship with the Warriors changed over the years, if at all?
When I first saw this movie, as I said, it felt more like a fun video game kind of movie where it's very simple. I could follow the story. It felt like it was adult, but it was accessible to me.
Right.
As I got older, I realized, and you know, I kind of mentioned it throughout, but I started seeing depth to the characters. I started recognizing the implications of the consequences they were facing. I started noticing eventually the filmmaking, the craft, you know, it led me, the Warriors really led me to Walter Hill as an artist. You know, I got to go, because of the Warriors, I sought out The Driver, and eventually Streets of Fire and, you know, Southern Comfort and the other movie that, you know, that I ended up really loving. And I started to think about the genre differently. I actually think it raised my standards for what I think is good action. You know, I mentioned action earlier, and it's not exclusively an action film, but it so informed my relationship with that type of movie that The Warriors is always kind of there. You know, when I watch any sort of action, I'm always going, could this be simpler? Could this be less complex? Because I think that helps action. I think, you know, the simpler, the more streamlined, the better. And I don't think there's a much better example of that than The Warriors. And that's something that I've kind of come to over time. And I'm always rediscovering it. I mean, just recently, Imprint put out a beautiful Blu-ray restoration, finally put the theatrical cut back on Blu-ray, because for a long time only the director's cut was available. And, you know, I picked that up. And, you know, anytime you rebuy a movie, it almost gives you this chance to, I get to see it again and watch it with new eyes. And it kind of forces you to reevaluate it. So I just, you know, reevaluated it again. And every single time I'm excited by it. I love it in different ways. And I'm excited to eventually show it to my kids. So it's just one of those movies that I don't think is really ever going to leave. You know, it's always going to be there.
It is the best example of a cult movie because it's just so timeless, and that mythological world that it takes place in. I mean, sure, we know that it's not, you know, a modern movie, but its themes, the way it's, the story is told is so beautifully, like a fairy tale or something. And yeah, it's such a well-made movie. And I love the earnest tone and such a surreal world. And yeah, I think you summed it up beautifully. And I'm super glad that we got to do The Warriors. And this is our season 2 finale. I can think of no better movie to go out, you know, to leave our listeners with this summer, you know, so that hopefully they're salivating for more as we plan season 3.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Paul. Where can people find you? What's coming up next? Tell them all the things.
Well, you can find me on Twitter mainly, and sometimes Instagram, at the always very modest handle at PaulIsGreat2000. I made that handle as a joke at a wedding years ago, and now I'm stuck with it forever. But here it is. And yeah, you put it very eloquently at the beginning. Most of my writing's on Bloody Disgusting. I do 2 columns right now. One on Hammer, of course, because I'm always writing or talking about Hammer. I do a column called Hammer Factory, where I basically just highlight a Hammer film that's been recently restored by Scream Factory. So I kind of look at the disc, but also take a look at the context of the film, review the film. I do that monthly. And then currently I'm doing a Goosebumps column because I'm a big R.L. Stine fan. And I actually got an R.L. Stine email recently, which was pretty cool, about my column. So that was fun from him. But yeah, monthly I take one of the books and one of the episodes that was adapted in the 90s for Fox Kids. And I break down the book and the episode and how it was adapted and what the changes were and stuff like that. So it's kind of a fun, nostalgic walk through the halls of Goosebumps. So you can check that out.
Love that. Listeners, go keep up with Paul on all of his various exploits. And Paul, thank you so much for taking a walk with us to Coney Island today.
Thanks for having me.
That was the fabulous Paul Farrell. Oh my God, such a smart guy. Like, I was getting so excited and then didn't really know how to respond other than say, oh my God, I just love what you just said.
What I really like about Paul's origin with the Warriors is, having seen it on TNT, you know as well as I do that the movie was definitely edited for television. And yet he still found himself drawn into the movie because even with the censorship of it, what was special about the Warriors shone through enough that it found its way into his heart. And then, of course, over the years, he, you know, saw it subsequently on VHS and became a super fan. But it just speaks to the fact that you can't keep good art down. And when it needs to connect with someone, it will connect with someone.
When you think about what we used to do to watch movies and how we watched movies, like just the idea of watching a movie on TNT, young people today don't understand like what we went through. He said that he recorded it on VHS. Do you remember like hitting record and then commercials would come and you had to decide whether or not you were going to record the movie with the commercials, which is shitty because then when you watch it the next time you have to fast forward through the commercials, or if you were going to like edit out the commercials in real time. Like, kids today, they don't know. They're streaming all this shit. You know, it looks fabulous. They're not having to patiently wait and hit record and all that shit. So, you know, the fact that these movies end up being something that we revisit on VHS with probably terrible commercials is a testament to how much we love these movies. And yeah, TNT, I remember it well. It was cable television at its worst.
A lot of my gateway into horror and exploitation and B movies and sex comedies was through USA Up All Night, which was very similar. Even though USA Up All Night was hosted by Rhonda Shear and she, you know, had this whole character of video vixen, sex kitten, and you kind of felt like you were seeing something naughty. In retrospect, they were still cutting those movies for TV, but by even creating the allure of it, you didn't necessarily process that till later. And so I'm sure that while watching Friday the 13th Part 7 on Up All Night, I thought that I was seeing way more than I was. It's absolutely true. Kids today do not realize the hurdles that prior generations had to jump through. We had to wait for Elvira or Rhonda or Joe Bob Briggs to host an edited version of the movie that our parents weren't letting us see. And just, you know, that was it. That was the gateway.
Yeah, actually, now that I think about it, USA and TNT were like, kind of like sister cable channels when you think about it, like very, very similar. Yeah, but if you were lucky, you either had a friend or your parents subscribed to, you know, one of the premium channels like HBO or Showtime or something, or best of all, Skinamax. And you got to see, you know, oh my God, do you remember the Spice Channel? Watching the Spice Channel through like blurry. This is such a weird memory, but it's definitely a generational thing. But there was a time where pornography, like hardcore pornography, would play on cable television, but it was scrambled, but you could still make out shapes and sound.
Like a boob would float by on the static. Yeah. Oh my God, I totally remember.
Is that a dick? Oh my God, is that a penis? And you could hear them having sex, but you know, you had to de-scramble it, and you couldn't. Or your parents would know because it would show up on their bill that you paid for the Spice Channel.
Oh, no, I totally remember that because we would have these like sleepovers. And I remember my parents were the ones who had the satellite TV. So we would sit there and like we would be watching things. And my friend James was always just like, I got to see a boob. And then like if you heard the basement door open, it'd like click over to like we were fucking watching Nickelodeon. Right.
Oh my God.
Of course, I think our parents totally knew that we were trying to watch that stuff. It's all part of the game, really.
I guess they did. I don't know. Probably. Anyway, the Warriors.
Leave it to us to get completely derailed in the season finale.
Something tells me that the listeners are perverted people. They liked movies about gangs and, you know, dressing up in baseball jerseys and wearing makeup. Men who wear makeup dressed in baseball uniforms. If you are the kind of person who wants to run through the streets of New York wearing God knows what, roller skates, leather vests,
a satin jacket, perhaps
a satin jacket, perhaps while drinking a soda, perhaps. You too may be one of the children of the popcorn now. We'll see you soon for season 3. Mwah!
Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.